The simple, hello, how are you? It's innocent enough, it's polite and expected of us when crossing paths with each other, but the words we use in reply are nothing short of loaded. Say too much or answer too honestly, and we risk making it awkward for all involved. And so, as is often the case, we complete the transaction of interaction with the simple, I'm great, how about you? But there's been a shift over the past few years, and it is a troubling one. Rather than a pithy, cheery reply, we're in the habit now of answering with a surprisingly complicated phrase, and it is this: oh, I'm crazy busy. In those simple words, we bring up notions of expectations, productivity, capitalism, our core beliefs around leisure and laziness, our productivity and our value, about language and achievement, about even narrative and reality. A recent-ish Gallup poll indicated a majority of Americans reported not having enough time for things they most wanted to do. So what gives here? We prize being busy as an ideal, yet we aren't getting around to doing the things we most want to do. It's fine to be busy, and it's fine to have a week or two here or there that stretches our capacity, no doubt. But we've moved into a place that looks a lot more like chronic busyness, busyness as the default setting of our lives, in which we do what's more immediate and not what we most want. And to not be busy suddenly means we're either, say, lazy and unambitious at one end of the spectrum, or terminally affluent at the other end. Not, say, just a person who took care of things on her list and had time left over to relax. That seems a bit broken. So pervasive is the assumption that busy equals value and status that we even use it as both an excuse and a compliment when we want to ask someone a question. Think about it. How many emails have you gotten that open like this? Hi there, I know you're busy. See what I'm saying? And look, we're burning out. A recent study by Kronos and published by Forbes polled U.S. HR leaders, and 95% of them indicated employee burnout is gutting the workforce, causing high employee dissatisfaction and turnover rates. And demands, particularly around work hours, scored very high as a culprit. So busyness is real, but is the way we talk and think about how busy we are contributing, if not downright prizing and rewarding, the culture of too busy? Is living in a state of constant stress helping any of us? And are we as overwhelmed as we think? That's what we aim to find out tonight, and maybe expand our thinking on the matter a little bit too. After all, shouldn't we value our being more than our doing? Let's think about that. I'm Amy Guth, and that's all coming up tonight on the Saturday Night Special on 720 WGN.
Live from the biggest small town in America,
this is WGN Chicago, radio home of millions throughout mid-America.
Radio, well, radio became the Pied Piper to a strange new world.
On our big shoulders and get inside our massive heart.
This is the Saturday Night Special with Amy Guth.
You heard the woman. This is the Saturday Night Special, and I'm Amy Guth. And tonight we are talking about the notion of chronic busyness. Yes, indeed. People are busier than ever before. And yes, hundreds of lights and ads and tasks and pings and bells compete for our attention in a given day. But what is all of that for? And is the way that we're talking about our activity and productivity levels making it worse? Maybe. The bigger question here, too, is what does it say about us as a culture to put so much value on activity over achievement, over doing, over being? Well, perhaps quite a lot. As ever, we'll have guests joining us to talk about different aspects of this topic. Jan Jakimovic, Columbia University PhD candidate, will join us to dive into the history, psychology, and narratives that came to create the culture of the chronically busy. Laura Vanderkam, author of I Know How She Does It, will join us to talk about her book, her radical experiment with time, and to challenge us. Indeed, because she says that we have a whole lot more time than we think. We will also be joined by psychologist Dr. Lisa Kaplan to help us dig into what motivates us to stay busy in the first place, both in the positive and the negative sense of that. And Fast Company writer Vivian Zhang will join us to talk about the health implications of being so darn busy. And of note, in planning this show and talking about it with others, the reaction for many was a pretty defensive one. How precious our busyness is to us when it represents so much. So with open minds, let's get into it. We'll be right back to get the conversation underway on 720 WGN. WGN hits. Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight and sharing part of your Saturday evening with me. I'm always grateful to you for that. As ever, we pick one topic and we talk about it all evening long. And as ever, what seems like a very simple topic quickly reveals itself to be much more complicated than we might think. The topic tonight is busyness. We think, oh, busy is good, but sometimes busy is very, very bad. And sometimes we just say we're busy when we're not busy. Sometimes we believe we're busy when we're not that busy. It's complicated, but we have a lot of very smart people joining us tonight to help us unpack that topic and talk all about it and consider all the many aspects of it. And we were expecting to have Vivian Zhang from Fast Company on. We cannot get a hold of her, and that's okay. We roll with it because she wrote a really interesting piece. I was so looking forward to having you hear from her about this piece, but she wrote a piece in Fast Company that is called How Busyness Affects Your Brain and Health, which I think is so interesting. Interesting, because it is really taking a look at kind of the health aspects and the health impacts. You know, we all know, right? Stress is killing us, and all of those things are happening. And we hear about sitting sitting at our desk is killing us, and the way we're holding our neck and our cell phones and all those things are killing us. But there was a study. It was out of the University of Texas, and it looked at this very thing. It looked at how it really impacts your brain. And you know what? It was not all as negative as we think. And the good news is we found Vivian. We have her here right now. Welcome to the program, Vivian. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you doing tonight?
Great. Thank you so much for being with us. So we are talking about your piece that you have at Fast Company about how busyness impacts your brain and your health. And I think that is so interesting. We're talking all about busyness on the program tonight. And I think we think about it being as, oh, we're run down, we'll catch up on sleep. But in fact, this study that we were just mentioning through the University of Texas, it looked at it and had some pretty surprising results. If you could take us through those.
Right. So this, you know, right now a lot of people are trying to do research and study about the brain and busyness. And the reason why is it's the first time that we are able to even look at the brain in a way that we are doing right now. And we are also living much longer lives. So people want to know how our lifestyle is going to be affecting our brain in the long term, how working on the internet, how the fact that we're constantly responding to emails, constantly working on a 24/7 type of work schedule is going mm-hmm. to be affecting our brain. And this study basically looked at just that as well. It looked at how the cognitive abilities of people who are constantly busy, right? And it found that that busier people perform much better on cognitive tests. I guess, you know, it's easy to understand why this is so, because if you're always busy and you're always doing certain types of work, maybe that is also working out your brain as well. If you've ever learned to speak a new language or play a new instrument, or just learn something where to the point where your brain hurts, that is like exercise for your brain. And we need to be doing that a lot more, just like we exercise our bodies, from what I'm told.
Right. Well, it's interesting, right? Because there seems to be a little bit of a balance there, because as we talk about stress, it's so emphasized to us that stress is killing us. It's hurting us. Sitting down is killing us. All of these things, it's leading to really serious illness and any type of sedentary lack of activity, any of that is really, really hurting us. And we equate that with busyness, like sitting at a desk for a long period of time. So it seems that there's this cognitive payoff despite the physical negative impact.
Right. And the truth of the matter is there just isn't. Think about the type of work style that we have right now. We're the first people who are living it, right? So we can't really know the impact of what it's doing into our brain for many more generations. And we don't really know what that busy lifestyle, that always on, you know, technological lifestyle is doing to us. The study also said that, it could be that busyness could contribute to higher levels of stress, but it could also be that people who reported to higher levels of busyness may be also in jobs where they are under intense pressure. So it seems like it's kind of, you know, it's good, but it's also there are some things that we should be also worried about.
Right. And I think what I got anyway from the piece that you wrote at Fast Company, and everybody head to fastcompany.com and look at this piece. It's really quite interesting. And there's links to a lot of this research that I thought was really, really compelling, was that it's not just busyness that is boosting this or potentially boosting this cognitive edge. But in fact, it's a matter of diversifying those tasks. As you said, learning a language, learning an instrument, and keeping the brain agile with new tasks and new neural passageways. That seemed to be the name of the game for that kind of success.
Right. It's just continuously honing in on different parts of your brain that you're using less frequently. So I've also spoken to, a few neuroscientists who have told me this, you know, this idea that we're living much longer. And we don't really know if our brains and our bodies can keep up with medicine and technology because of the way that we are living, because we're always in tune, because, if you think about if you're doing a task every day, soon enough, it'll get easier and easier, and you won't even have to think about it anymore. You're no longer working out those muscles or working out those parts of your body. So you have to almost keep trying different things in order to surprise your body, right, to keep in shape. And you have to do the same thing with your brain.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of this research is in Frontiers in Aging Neuroscience. You can read a lot of this in depth, which I thought was really, really quite interesting. You do point to in the how this same study doesn't look as much at that long-term effect of this on the physical body, just the brain part. But, you know, we do know anecdotally, right? We hear so much about how keeping ourselves in this fight or flight mode drains the adrenal system and keeps us in this state of stress and deals with, you know, metabolism and all these things it's allegedly damaging us. But I think that is an interesting point to consider that I don't think is part of the conversation often. And that is, we're the ones blazing this trail because we're really the first ones in this hyper connected 24/7 kind of era.
Right. Mm-hmm. You're completely right. I mean, we don't know what living this way is doing to our brains right now. We don't know the fact that, you know, life has become more stressful or busy or jam-packed, exactly what that's doing if we're constantly feeling anxiety. Even though we're performing better on these cognitive tests, like the study found, what is that doing to us long-term? We don't know, and probably the generation after us will know much better.
Right, right. They'll blame us for all of those things as younger generations do with older generations. I think, too, part of this conversation is about attention span, because I think that's where we usually go first when we talk about what technology is doing to us neurologically. I think there's that piece of it, too, that I can't help but wonder about. And I know that wasn't too much a part of this study in particular, but I do wonder, you know, maybe our brains will be more agile, but the attention span could suffer because we have all these different pathways. Who knows? As you say, it will be a generation or two down the road once we figure it out, perhaps.
Right. And, you know, you think about the way that we're reading, you know, we are reading, you know, used to be books and now it's, you know, it's we're reading online and it's tweets and right. Now it's tweets are getting too long. So it's, you know, Snapchat, you know, and there is a difference between using the focus and unfocused part of your brain. I think if you think about, for instance, if you think about the way that information is processed, right, you're using 98% of your 98% of your mental activity is unconscious. So even thinking about, you know, your unconscious brain and how and your focus and all of that and in your attention span, and how all of that impacts your decision making, especially if you are working in a high stress, high anxiety type of job, how that all comes together is also, you know, and how that affects your brain, I think is also really interesting.
Yeah, a lot here. Again, find this piece at fastcompany.com, how busyness affects your brain and health. There's links in the piece to a lot of this research that's really, really interesting. I recommend you read it. Vivian, thank you so much for being with us tonight. Vivian Jiang, business writer, gender leadership, entrepreneurship, workplace psychology, all kinds of things at Fast Company. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much. All right. We're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation about busyness. We're going to check in with Dr. Lisa Kaplan. She is a psychologist, and she is going to talk with us a little bit about why we do the things we do. Why are we so busy, both in the positive and the negative? We'll wrestle with all that stuff when we come back on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight. We had to play a little bit of the Bangles. How could you not play the song Manic Monday on a show about busyness, the culture of busyness, chronic busyness, overwhelm, all of those things that we wrestle with so much in our modern lives. So as ever, we're sticking with that topic for the night, and we have many, many very smart people coming in to help us talk about it, different aspects of it. We're joined now by a guest you may remember. She's been on this show before, Dr. Lisa Kaplan, who is a psychologist. You can find out more about her work and all the things that she does at Smart Women Inspired Lives.com. Hi there. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Lisa Kaplan. How are you?
Hi, Amy. How are you?
Good. So good to hear your voice again. Thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Well, so busyness, it's a thing. It is a thing we've been talking about. We were just talking with Vivian Jiang from Fast Company, talking about how it impacts our brain, good and bad. So, you know, the stress part, it negatively impacts our health, our physical health, but our brain health, there's an advantage to sometimes trying new things and juggling a lot of stuff. But the emotional part, that's where it breaks bad. That's where sometimes the littlest thing makes you just cry and just like breaks the dam, and you just suddenly your overwhelm just kind of spills over. So what are you seeing in terms of busyness and how it manifests in our lives emotionally?
I see it as almost an addiction. It's just another way to not be present. So it's almost a covering of emotions, you know, like drinking or gambling or cheating or any of those other things that we do to not really look at what's going on for ourselves. We get busy, and then we don't have to stop and really think about how am I feeling or what might be bothering me in my life, or any of those pieces that we like to avoid.
Right. I think that's common, right? We want to like seem together and seem successful. So we get really attached to doing lots of stuff. But sometimes those are just kind of, I'm not saying busyness is not real, because it's certainly real. We've all had our stretches of being super busy and stressed out with real things. But sometimes I hear that. Sometimes we get into a pattern where like a week will go by and you feel like you're super slammed, but Friday comes around, you're like, what in the heck did I do this week? I accomplished nothing, but I felt super busy. And I think that's that thing you're talking about there, that it's just kind of a matter of keeping ourselves distracted from maybe something that we're sitting with or not wanting to sit with.
Exactly. And I also think sometimes the busyness is, if we're not busy, we're not productive, as if taking care of ourselves or resting isn't productivity. So it's really got a negative label on it. Not being productive has a negative label on it. So we don't want to seem that we're not productive. And it also is a good excuse to avoid any feelings or scary thoughts coming into our mind. So it's an easy way to really almost be addicted.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very, very true. I think that particularly, I mean, I think it's a classic thing, right? If you see of like a kid maybe with like a rough home life, or maybe even an adult, like things are not going well mm-hmm. at home, so they throw themselves into work or school or something like that. I think it's maybe, do you think that it's learned that early and that this is like a piece of that?
You know, it's interesting. I just read an article about today's kids, these very, very highly productive, highly educated, achieving kids. They have no idea how to not be that, how to relax, how to enjoy life. So I think we're passing it on, and we're all saying to ourselves, not all, but many of us are saying to ourselves, you know, busy is good. It's like the sanctioned way to not really relax because, oh, look at how busy she is. Look at how and how much she's achieving or he's achieving. It's kind of allowed.
Yes, absolutely. That's scary. Mm-hmm. The idea that you know, young people can't sit, or actually big people too, right? Not just littles, but bigs too. The idea of not being able to just kind of sit and check in and say, okay, how am I feeling right now? There's a lot going on in my life. How am I doing? Or even that you would need to necessarily have to probe that much that you couldn't just kind of tell. That's disturbing. And so when, if you go for a long period of time, very, very busy and not checking in with yourself, where do you see that? How does that manifest in your life later? Because I feel like it's got to come out eventually.
Oh, exactly. I'm guessing it's going to come out in relationships. I'm not guessing. I think we've seen it. It comes out in relationships. It comes out in really a day where you just, you know, wake up and realize, what have I really been doing? You know, what is my purpose? How have I connected with the people that I love? How about, you know, doing something that feels more than just being busy? Or how about even a physical health, mental health, all those things can go down if we're not checking in with ourselves saying, how am I doing? You know, do I need a little downtime? Do I need to, you know, take a breath, relax, whatever it is?
Right. So let's shift this to the positive, though, because mm-hmm. there's, I'm sure, plenty of folks that are having the opposite situation of wishing they could be more motivated to do more and to accomplish more, the opposite of being too busy and overwhelmed. And
yes.
And is that driven by a lot of the same stuff? Because I feel like we come to that narrative a lot when we're talking with mental health professionals on this show of sometimes two polar opposites are in fact driven by the same core thing in our psyche.
Yes. Exactly. I mean, depression can show up as busyness, and depression can also show up as apathy or, you know, a lack of motivation. Anxiety is the same thing. So we can see it on either extremes. So, you know, the lack of busyness might be chosen. It might be a reaction to other things that are going on with us.
So then how do we even begin to fix that? If we're saying, okay, I feel like I'm maybe spinning my wheels either because mm-hmm. I cannot get motivated, but probably more likely is the case because I feel like our culture really supports and rewards, and our language really supports and rewards this chronic activity, constant activity, yeah. constantly doing and doing and doing. And I think even kind of punishes leisure time. I think there, particularly, I think for women, there's a narrative of guilt attached to relaxing and taking time for yourself, to the extent that a lot of us will go to social media and declare, I did this, 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 and this, therefore I'm going to treat myself with this hour at the bookstore or whatever. You know?
Like, yes, as if I couldn't take the hour at the bookstore unless I achieved, you know, I moved the world in some way.
Right.
That's not allowed. It can only be in reward form.
I think we do the same thing with food. I recall yeah. one time hearing, there was a table near me of a lot of women having lunch together, and it was a like the question of dessert came up, and it was really like, well, I don't know, I've been good. And it was really, it was like justifying. And I just want to turn and be like, just order the dang cake, lady. Like, come on, let's just do
exactly.
this.
You're allowed to just enjoy it for what it is.
Right. So I think there's a lot of narratives there. There's a lot of stuff. We need to take a little break, but I want to talk about that when we come back, about how our language perhaps reinforces a lot of this in our minds and hearts and emotions and all that, because that can be a lot to bear. We're talking with Dr. Lisa Kaplan. She's a psychologist. You can find out more about her and her work at smartwomeninspiredlives.com. We will be right back at 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Got to get a little Smiths in there. A little Morrissey shout out every show, as much as we can anyway. We're talking about chronic busyness tonight. And I am surprised that that is as polarizing of a topic as it is. But indeed, here we are. We are mighty attached to our busyness because it represents what we're doing. We sometimes attach our value to what we feel we're accomplishing. We attach our value to our goals, sometimes our activity. It gets complicated really fast, and that brings up a lot of stuff. So I don't know that we're going to have time for a lot of calls tonight because we have a lot of guests. We have a lot of things to talk about. But nonetheless, I appreciate your calls and texts and tweets and all that. Thank you for listening. I appreciate it very much. But nonetheless, it is a polarizing topic. It is a tricky one because it brings up a lot of stuff. And so that is why we are joined by our friend, Dr. Lisa Kaplan. She's a coach and a psychologist. You can read about all the work that she does at smartwomeninspiredlives.com. And she's helping us unpack and sort all of this stuff because it's so darn complicated. So right before the commercial break, we were talking about the narratives around it and language and how even our language doesn't really support us just relaxing and just taking a break. We feel like we have to make a declaration and say, look, I did the following. I moved these mountains. I won this award. I did this thing. Nothing is left hanging. Now I'm going to take a break.
Right. Exactly. Excuse me. Sorry about that.
That's all right.
I think the concept of I'm going to choose to be lazy or choose to relax or choose to take some time, some downtime, and not have an excuse around it or a reward around it is unheard of.
Yeah. It is. It's really, I'm trying to think of when was the last time I heard someone just go, I'm going on vacation because I deserve it. I don't think I've heard anyone do that in a very long time.
No, or even because I want to.
Right, right. Exactly. Or even because I want to. That's very true. We are so entrenched in this idea of being so, so busy that I almost think it's shifting away from who's accomplishing the most and into a place of who's the busiest, who's doing the most.
Yes, there's like some unspoken status symbol for being busy, just doing.
It's true. It's so true. Mm-hmm. I mean, as I said in the opening monologue, it's complicated because if you think about how often emails start with, hi, I know you're busy, but like, well, you know, you don't.
Right.
You don't know what I am. I might be, but I might not be. So it's almost a compliment and it's almost a pardon, sorry to interrupt you, but then it also, it's just our standard answer for how are you doing? Oh, I'm so busy.
I'm busy. It's the first thing we say. I'm busy. Good, but busy.
Yeah. Yeah. Busy, but good. And people go, oh, what a good problem to have. I know. Great. Bye. And you're like, what? What just happened? We said nothing.
Right.
We did not bond as human beings. I think there's underneath this, there's a little bit of a call towards more precision of language and a little bit of radical honesty. And I know it can be awkward if someone says, how are you? And you're like, well, I'm depressed or stressed or I'm not feeling well. That could be weird. But I think there is something to be said for being a little clearer with where we really are when we're talking to people.
Yes, and a little more real.
Yeah, that too.
There's a lack of authenticity in some of the language.
Well, certainly that too. That's a whole other show. We got to have a whole other show about authenticity and lack of it and all that. So then how do we fix it? So in your work, I'm sure you interact with a lot of people who are coming to you saying, I'm overwhelmed. I'm not doing the things I want to do. I'm spinning my wheels. I'm freaking out. Time is flying by. So how do we start to undo this when we're very deeply entrenched in busyness and even our culture and language supports us being that way? How do we get out of it?
The best way to get out of it is to, if this is going to sound a little woo-woo, but is to get conscious, really conscious in that we're choosing. And if we're conscious and we choose to be busy because we love what we do and we feel passion around it, then that's fine. It's the choice versus the reaction that's the key. So when we're unconsciously just going to avoid something or just because we think that's what we should be doing, there's no real choice there.
Right.
So choosing busyness, conscious busyness, conscious not being busy, conscious being lazy, whatever you want to call it, but it's all around choice.
And how do we fight that narrative and that thing that really makes us feel guilty for wanting to just chill out?
That's like five shows. The guilt is
guilt. The guilt show.
It's like a guilt year that we would need to cover that.
True.
And I think it's really catching what we're saying to ourselves. Are we saying, oh, I should be busy? You know, are we shitting on ourselves? I should be busy. I should be doing that. And as soon as we hear that, it's really getting clear in our heads about what do I want? And I'm choosing it and really thinking about guilt is only functional if we use it to improve some piece of our life. Otherwise, it's completely useless.
Oh, I like that. Everybody write that down. That's a good one. Guilt is only functional if we're using it to improve a part of our lives. I like that. Well, the thing I'm really hearing right now is this idea of should. The shoulds always wreck things. Those guys show up and wreck everything every time. We get on the wrong career path because we think we should. Like people choose the wrong partner because they think they should pick a particular kind of person or someone in a particular profession or something like that. People make all kinds of decisions based on the shoulds. And it sounds like this is very attached to that should, because if you're struggling with, oh, I can't go on vacation right now because I really should get to the bottom of my to-do list. I really should clean the house. I really should do all these things. So it sounds like it's a lot of that same should stuff that is holding us back from giving ourselves a dang break.
Exactly. It really is. Anytime you hear yourself saying I should or I need to, you've moved away from choice and you're moving into some other space that's got all these messages, you know, and there are our own messages that say, if I don't do this, I'm not really good enough in some way.
Right.
And so if I'm not busy, I must not be a good person. I must not be a productive person. I must not be a smart person. And so I'm going to get busy to show myself and everybody else how important I am.
Right. Well, I think there's that too. And I think a piece of this we haven't touched on yet is there is sometimes a false narrative. And often when we're dealing with truth, sometimes telling ourselves the truth is the hardest truth to tell of all.
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. To look ourselves in the mirror and say, you know, I'm trying to prove that I mean something by being busy and it's not working.
Yeah.
That's hard to say. It's hard to look at.
Sure. I think especially when you're, I see this a lot with you know, I interview a lot of startups and entrepreneurs and serial entrepreneurs and things like that. And a lot of people in that maker space and a lot of people that are exploring different parts of the gig economy. And I think there it's very loaded because then it becomes about proving that you're moving forward and proving that you're doing the things you're setting out to do.
Yes, exactly. You know, and think about even how a lot of businesses, a lot of corporations are set up. They're constantly moving the carrot. You have to constantly be growing. If you're not growing, you're dying. And so, you know, that means there's a difference between growing and just being busy. And I think we've lost the meaning of that. Because often growing can be in the sitting still and the taking care of ourselves. We're growing.
Right. And having an epiphany. And I think, too, we don't give ourselves time for contemplation. And I think that's a really important one that It doesn't look like you're doing anything if you're contemplating. You're probably just sitting there. But really profound things could come up. You could cure a disease or, you know, come up with something really, really big.
Yes, exactly. How many things could you solve not being busy, just by sitting and thinking about something? And it's really hard to do. We're in such a fast-paced world, and, you know, with the technology and everything, it's hard to actually just sit still.
Yeah. And so where do boundaries fit in here? Because, you know, we're starting to hear, you know, France just passed a law where you can't employ emails after a certain hour. That's a no-no. Mm-hmm. And there's some German companies that I was looking at earlier today that are experimenting with even shutting down email servers a half hour after work hours and things like that.
Yeah.
And I think that just feels light years away in this country for sure.
Yes, I see so many people who tell me that they'll get up in the middle of the night and check email so that they don't have to wake up in the morning to a bunch of emails from work. And so in the middle of the night, they're essentially working. And I think we're not going to set boundaries until we believe we're worth those boundaries.
Mm.
And so until we think my time and my family or my personal life or whatever it is worth that to me, that at 5 o'clock I stop answering emails. You know, it's whatever time it is for you, or all weekend long, I don't work.
Yeah.
I don't know. Not many people do that anymore.
Oh, I know very, very few that do that. I think that you said a very key thing. It's deciding when you're worth those boundaries. That is a very, very important thing. And I would add to that, my grandmother has a saying that it's not her original one, but one she says often, and that is that you cannot pour from an empty cup, which I think is a very important one to remember. We have to recharge ourselves.
Absolutely. And are we worth it? And it takes time and energy to recharge. You're not doing it when you're just running around kind of mindlessly busy.
That is very, very true. Well, I think we created about five other more shows that we need to do that are spinoffs of this conversation, but we have run out of time for this. Dr. Lisa Kaplan, coach and psychologist, thank you so much for being with us tonight. Please
thank
go find you. More about her work at smartwomeninspiredlives.com and follow her on Twitter and Facebook and social media, all the social media. She's out there. She's doing the things. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Amy.
You bet. All right. We are going to take a little break and then get you to news. And when we come back, we are going to be talking with Laura Vanderkamp. She's an author, and she wrote a very, very interesting piece in the New York Times not so long ago. And she's author of several books that she makes the case that perhaps we might have more time than we think. So we're going to be talking with her when we come back here on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thank you for being with us tonight, and thank you for sharing part of your weekend with me. Always grateful to you for that. Tonight, as ever, we are picking one topic and talking about it all night long, and that topic tonight is busyness. It is a big deal, and we're quickly learning that it is a pretty polarizing topic. We're attached to this narrative that we tell ourselves that we are so busy. We attach our identity to it. We attach a lot of stuff to it, and it's bringing up stuff tonight for people. So I appreciate the calls and the texts and the tweets and all that good stuff. Don't know that we're going to have time for calls, very many, if at all, just because we have so many wonderful guests to get to. But nonetheless, we are talking about busyness tonight, and about a year ago, I read a piece in the New York Times that I thought was so powerful and so kick-ass and so good. I'm very, very excited to welcome the person who wrote that piece, and that is Laura Vanderkamp, who wrote this piece, as I said, in the New York Times, and it is all about the busy person's lies. It's about the things that we tell ourselves, the time that we tell ourselves we don't have, and she did a radical time experiment. Over the course of a year, has written many books about it, has written this piece, appeared in lots of places, talking about this very radical time experiment, and what she learned was very, very surprising. Laura, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate you taking time out of your weekend to join us, especially this topic is so important to me. And when I read this piece a year ago in the New York Times, I was like, oh my gosh, testify. I was so excited. And I thought it was so powerful. And the reaction to it was so interesting because some people, I mean, it was very polarizing right away. Some people were like, oh my gosh, you get me. And some people were like, how dare you? And I really feel like a lot of that is attached to us being attached to our narratives, us being attached to what we, the things we tell ourselves about our lives.
I totally agree. We are very attached to the narrative of being busy. And I think for many people, when that's challenged or when time is presented as more of a choice, we have the option of either saying, oh, that's interesting. Let me see if there's anything to that that might be helpful to me. Or else we can double down on the idea that, no, this person just doesn't understand X, Y, or Z about my life or somebody else's life or whatever. What's really funny is when people write very long article, like very long letters in response to a thing saying that we're not that busy, saying that they are really busy. They have no time, just enough time to write these long letters, I suppose.
Right, right. Of course, of course. Well, so what you did was, I would say, a radical experiment with time tracking, which was really very interesting. You answer a question that I had at the very top of the piece, later in the piece, and that was, how in the world did you have time to track your time? But nonetheless, you did. You tracked, was it half-hour increments?
Half-hour increments for an entire year.
And it took you less time than I would have thought. To me, in my head, I was like, oh, that must have taken hours. But it really boiled down to really just kind of minutes a day is what it sounds like.
It wasn't hard at all. It is kind of a myth that tracking time takes a lot of time. I suppose if you want to write down absolutely every single thing you do, it could. But I was okay with broad categories for those half-hour blocks. So I would say something like work, even though I might have gotten up and taken a bathroom break in the course of that half-hour block, or play with kids, even if it might have, you know, been various things during that time, or housework, or, you know, driving car. Or, you know, these are very broad categories. It just enough that I got the sense of where my time went. But because these categories just were a couple of words, it really only took me a couple minutes a day. I would estimate it was about 3 minutes a day, which if you think about it, is about the amount of time we spend brushing our teeth,
sure.
Which is, you know, a category of activity I've not seen fit to question because it's added to my life, and it's the same thing with time tracking.
Right. And so before anyone listening says, oh, I have kids and a job, and let me stop you and point out that during this year, Laura, that you were tracking this, you had your fourth child. You published
shortly before the year started. Yes. He was about 3 months old when the time tracking began.
Right. You published a book. You traveled to promote it. You did a lot of things. You know, you and your spouse coordinated all this stuff. There was a lot of spinning plates happening all at the same time during this year.
It was quite a year. And that's one of the reasons that I wanted to track it, is that it would show me what was truly going on during what I knew was going to be a fairly full period of my life. And partly it's fun to look back on it now and just to see, well, what is the rhythm of life like mm-hmm. with an infant, for instance? It becomes different in ways you don't even remember what it was like even, you know, 2 years later. So it's fun to look back on it from a nostalgic perspective. And also then you say, oh, yeah, you know, it was not that fun to be up at 4:30 in the morning right. day after day with the little guy.
Right, right. And so that was a leap year that you did that. So that totaled 8,784 hours in that year. And what you discovered was really, really interesting and really kudos to you, because I think we are so attached to the things we tell ourselves that, I mean, prior to reading this, I kind of suspected that, but deep down I thought, I probably don't even have time to track my time, much less do something like this to really examine that. But somewhere in me, I knew that I probably could find time if I really looked for it. And that is exactly what you did. By tracking this time, you were able to go back and look and see these patterns. And in fact, you revealed that you had quite a bit more time than you thought.
Yeah. I mean, and I write and talk about this topic. So it's not, you know, strange to me to right. know that how we think we spend our time often doesn't you know, relate to how we actually spend our time. And yet I thought I was immune to it because I speak and write about this topic. But it turned out that was not really the case. And I had the idea, for instance, that I worked about 50 hours a week. And that is because I had tracked my time for various weeks here and there over the years. And I'd always worked about 50 hours a week. But the funny thing is, when I started tracking my time continuously, I realized that I had chosen very specific weeks to track over the years, namely weeks when I worked 50 hours a week, because I wanted to see myself as the kind of person who was working 50 hours a week. And when I tracked for an entire year, of course, I could not do that, be so selective with them. And it turned out that the year-long average, even when I subtracted vacation weeks, was closer to 40. And 40 is a very different number than 50. That's 10 hours a week right there that I'm devoting to something else than what I thought I was devoting it to. And that doesn't mean that I never worked 50 hours a week, because there were several weeks that I worked 50 hours a week. There were even a week or two that I worked 60 hours a week. But the funny thing we do is that we tend to remember our longest weeks as typical. And I think that's where part of the misperception comes into play.
Indeed, indeed. And you get into that in this piece, even running into someone who claimed he worked more hours in a week at just guessing at his time than, in fact, there are hours. He overestimated by about 12 hours. He called his work week more hours than there are in an actual full week, sleeping, eating, working, all of those things. So we do perhaps change things in our heads to protect ourselves. We're talking right now with Laura Vanderkam. She's an author of I Know How She Does It, 168 hours, what most successful people do before breakfast. Wonderful, wonderful reading. And this New York Times piece about a year ago that came out that really challenges what we tell ourselves about time. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with her back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. As ever, we pick one big topic and talk about it all night long, looking at it from a variety of angles. And tonight, that topic is busyness. We have been talking about many different aspects of that. And we have been talking also with Laura Vanderkam, who writes all about time management. She wrote a book called 168 Hours, You Have More Time Than You Think. She wrote one called What Most Successful People Do Before Breakfast, and one called I Know How She Does It. I recommend all of those books. Very, very good. In particular, right now, we're talking about a piece that was in the New York Times about a year ago that when I read it, I said, whoa, this is for real, because it really suggests and comes right out and says, even it doesn't suggest, it says we have a lot more time than we think. At least many of us do. We have a lot more time than we think. And in fact, the idea of tracking our time to see where we maybe are telling ourselves some stories that are not quite true about our time, it is worth tracking our time to reveal those pockets of time and giving ourselves the gift of time back and realness with ourselves, in fact. So, Laura, thank you for staying with us. There's so much I still want to ask you about here. But there's a piece in your New York Times piece that really stands out to me, this one line in particular, that is about how this part of what we wrestle with when we maybe don't want to admit what we're telling ourselves about time is that it's very much attached to this narrative that professional success requires harsh sacrifices at home. And I think that probably hits women disproportionately more than it hits men.
There is definitely that narrative out there that in order to succeed professionally, you must be giving something up, and for women in particular, because we're expected to honor the home front more with our hours. And the funny thing is, though, when people do track their time, they see that often this is not as much of an either or question as it might appear to be. I mean, just a little bit of math here to throw this out there. There's 168 hours in a week, so that's 24 times 7. If you're working 40 hours a week, so a full-time job, and you're sleeping 8 hours a night, so that's 56 hours a week, that leaves 72 hours per week for other things. So that's kind of a lot of time. And even if you're working more, if you're working 50 hours a week, you know, that leaves 62 hours for other things. If we're working 60 hours a week, that leaves 52 hours for other things. So there's still a fair amount of time there to do other things in one's personal life. I mean, you often hear the phrase, we spend the majority of our waking hours at work, which is not actually true. I mean, if you were sleeping 56 hours a week, you'd have to be working 56 hours a week in order to have that be true, that you're spending the majority there. And the vast, vast, vast majority of people do not work that many hours.
Right.
And so it's just interesting to see this. And I've had women track their time for me and discover that they were spending incredible quantities of time with their children that they were just not giving each other themselves credit for, because it didn't occur at 10 a.m. on Tuesday, which is, I guess, when parenting must occur in order to count. But, you know, the hours before they left for work, or they'd come home at reasonable times, hang out in the evening with their families, do more work at night after the kids went to bed. So they were logging long hours, but still putting in a lot of family time too. And people would see that and be like, oh, you know, I used to feel guilty, but I really don't anymore after seeing this. And I find that that's actually one of the more heartening things I have seen come out of time tracking.
Yeah, I mean, what a gift to alleviate some guilt in your life. That's guilt can make us do all kinds of things, and all, you know, good and bad. Guilt can,
well, it can make us not be present for the time we have. I mean, if you're telling yourself, oh, I'm leaving my kid to go to work all day, you're not noticing that you've been up since 5:30 with the kid, and you're leaving for work at 8:30, and that's 3 hours that you could have been, you know, doing something together instead of being focused on getting out the door.
Yeah, I love the example in the piece that you wrote about the lawyer who works 60 hours a week, and she realized she actually was spending quite a lot of time with her child. She just, the way she split those 60 hours up, she didn't sacrifice weekends. She had two nights that she went a little bit longer, and she did a lot of work after the kid went to bed. But in fact, she was spending time with her child. And I'm sure that was a huge relief to her to have that kind of clarity. What a gift for her to suddenly go, oh, wait, I'm not messing this up. I'm actually doing okay here.
Yeah, and I think that would be good for perhaps younger women to see as well, because I think one of the narratives we hear, unfortunately, around professional women's circles is, you know, young women looking at the senior women in their firms and saying, well, there's nobody whose life I want. Mm-hmm. And I think, well, sometimes maybe we should have senior women at various companies track their time and show their schedules, because if you knew that you had the entire weekend for family stuff, you had 3 evenings a week, you had the morning time as well, that doesn't seem all that bad, honestly. And I think sometimes we have the narrative that it is so bad, and that keeps women from aiming for where their professional potential might be.
Sure. And I could see someone maybe thinking critically about this and saying this seems a little bit first world, and that there are plenty of people that have several jobs just to get buy and pay their way through the world and pay for their kids. And I hear that. But I think that there's a, you know, a probably a bigger lesson here about boundary, about I think getting sucked into that time narrative really does hurt everybody at every socioeconomic level, because there this expectation of constant activity and constant work seems like it would just leak to every worker everywhere.
I think there's something to that. I mean, I also can tell you from conversations I have that complaints about being busy are a very first world problem,
sure.
In the sense that many people who have very tough lives are not the ones who complain vocally in various blogs and, you know, fora and such about it. But then there's also the issue that in many cases, people who have the toughest life would actually like to work more, but many people these days can't get all the hours they want in various jobs that have gone part-time that they don't wish to be part-time. So it's a very complicated issue. But I think in general, it serves us best to approach our time as much as possible from the perspective of choices. And that doesn't, of course, mean that everyone has complete freedom of how to decide how to spend their hours. I mean, hopefully that would be an ideal we could work toward, but obviously it's not reality for most people. But we all have at least some sphere within our time. Maybe if we put in a long day of work and childcare, or work or childcare, you know, you might have an hour before bed, and that's yours to do what you wish to do with it. And what are you going to do? What's your choice? I mean, you can watch TV, of course. You can surf social media and be, you know, unhappy about your life compared to other people's lives. Right. Or you could read, you know, you could read a really good book. You could, you know, run yourself a bath. You could relax and look at the stars. You can talk with your partner or call a friend or something like that. I mean, we have a choice over some sphere of our lives. And ideally, eventually the sphere will expand. But even if it's a small one, exercising that choice can make us feel so much more in control of our lives.
Truly. And I love the last line of this piece that you had at the New York Times, and that is, life is full and life has space. There is no contradiction here. I think that is so lovely. Everybody, go find these books. If this is a topic that is interesting to you, go find these books. There is 168 Hours, You Have More Time Than You Think, What Most Successful People Do Before Breakfast, and I Know How She Does It, all by Laura Vanderkam. Thank you so much for being with us, Laura. It was so nice to talk with you about all this.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. All right, we are going to take a break, get you to news, and when we come back, we are talking with a PhD candidate from Columbia who applies history and culture and all of these big topics to this topic to help us kind of rewrite that narrative and rethink the way we think about busyness. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. As ever, we pick one big topic and we talk about it all evening long. And tonight's topic, of course, is busyness, in particular, chronic busyness, because as I have talked about many, many times on this show over the years, it drives me crazy, and I know many of you too, when we speak to each other and say, hello, how are you? How have you been? I haven't seen you in so long. How's it going? And the answer is, oh, I'm crazy busy, as if that's supposed to be an ideal. So that's what we've been unpacking tonight and talking about many, many different aspects of it. We're joined now by Jan Jakimovic, who is a PhD candidate at Columbia and has written about this very thing recently on Huffington Post. Welcome to the program, Jan.
Good evening, Amy. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So this piece that you wrote about on Huffington Post really, really grabbed me right away because it opens with exactly what I was just talking about. It opens with this phenomenon of how it seems somehow valuable or desirable to answer people the simple and ubiquitous, how are you? It seems like we're supposed to answer it with, oh, I'm so busy. I'm crazy busy. And you write about that right at the top of the piece. But then you go on to dissect it a little bit. And you mentioned two books in particular, written about 5 years apart, about the turn of the century, that that I've talked about on this program before, too, that you really feel are kind of pinpoint as laying the groundwork for why that is the case here in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first book is Max Weber's book on the theory of the leisure class, of the leisure class. And that book, really, what it does is it gives us a little bit more detail about the Protestant work ethic. So it's this idea from Protestantism that engaging in hard work is a signal that at one point, once we die, we're going to make it into heaven, that in the afterlife, we will be rewarded for what happened in this life, the life that we're currently living. And so by engaging in a lot of hard work and by embracing this work ethic, it might not necessarily be pleasurable in the moment, but the idea of the Protestant work ethic is that in the long run, it will pay off, and it will pay off when we are able to go to heaven after we die. And this work ethic is widely permeated throughout the United States. And so when people proclaim that they're busy, one way to think about it or one way to look at it is through the lens of the Protestant work ethic. Are they just signaling that they have a really arduous work ethic, that they're working really hard on something, and that ultimately we take that as a signal that they are virtuous? And that because they're virtuous, they're going to get payoffs at some point in the future.
Right. Well, and even the American dream is sort of built around that idea that if you work hard and put in the time and really hustle, that you can do anything that you want. You will be successful. You will have some kind of security. It's even built kind of around that as a metaphor even.
Well, it's not just on the American dream. I think we can make it more local and call it the New York dream. I mean, how many of us move to New York City with a dream and ambition, some kind of goal, and then we find ourselves in New York and apartments aren't very big and everything costs a lot of money. And one way to signal to others and perhaps even to ourselves that what we're doing is really worth it is by highlighting the struggles that we're facing and by, you know, making it all sound like we're making progress toward our goal. You know, like I'm busy. Things are working out for me. I've got all these auditions if I want to be an actor, or, you know, I'm killing it at my investment banking job and I'm really making progress. I'm crazy busy. And this crazy busy perhaps is some kind of way for us to provide some kind of rationale for the way in which perhaps the status quo, what I'm living, isn't quite as pleasurable, but it's all worth it in the long run. And it's all worth it because the struggles that I'm encountering in the long run, they're going to help me attain the goal that I wanted to move to New York for in the first place.
Right, right. And I, you know, you said something that made me think of a sort of a tangent here, and that is even the language we use around being busy and successful is so weirdly aggressive, as if it's something you have to go and kill. You know, we say we're killing it, we're crushing it, we're, you know, I dominated, I murdered that president. Like, people use this really aggressive and weirdly dangerous language when we talk about our goals that I think is tied in with this somehow.
Yeah, and one thing that goes missing is, you know, acknowledging all the setbacks, acknowledging all the failures, acknowledging all of our vulnerabilities that don't really come into play while doing that, because they're often perceived as a sign of weakness, whereas really we're all experiencing setbacks all the time. Even, you know, even if we're killing it, even if things are crazy busy, I take on a lot of things. Some of the things are just not going to work out, just probabilistically.
Right.
That's just how it is. But we don't emphasize them in the American culture at all. We just continue killing it. We continue going forward in the hopes of attaining our dreams.
Right. So we talked about The Protestant Work Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, that book. And let's shift to this other book that you mentioned in the piece, The Theory of the Leisure Class, that really talks a little more about a different way that tends to be a little more European of how we show status of doing the opposite of crazy busy, showing that we have time for leisure, time for family, things like that, and how that has been more valuable in European culture than in American.
Yeah, so there was a book written by Thorstein Veblen in 1899, who was actually an American economist and sociologist, who kind of gave us the idea of scarcity, and that is, how can I show to another person that I am valuable, that I am someone of esteem, someone of status, someone to be admired? And one way to do that, one way to distinguish myself from others, is doing things that others can't do easily, right? Because if I do something that others can do, then there's no way for us to distinguish ourselves from each other. But if doing something that others can't do, well, then perhaps I'm able to attain higher levels of status in their eyes, at least. And one thing that Veblen really landed on was, well, if everyone has to work really hard in order to make a living, if everyone has to be, you know, crazy busy in 19th century terms, and I am not busy, if I can not only not be busy, but show off that I have all this free time, all this leisure time that I spend off in, you know, in activities that perhaps might be costly, but at least are activities that are readily observable, then others are going to think, wow, you know, she has so much time. She's, you know, she doesn't have to work for a living and she can have so much fun. And so we often associate that with, you know, really images of a British royalty who might be playing polo. And those are just the images that we have in mind of people who are a very high status. And it's kind of interesting that stands in contrast to people who are crazy busy, who, you know, at the end of the day want to attain their goal. They want to attain higher status. But by doing that, kind of fall prey to this the fallacy that sometimes, you know, showing off that we have a lot of leisure can also be a way to show other people that we have a lot of status.
Right. And yet we see headlines all the time about how, you know, busyness is killing us, and sitting down all day at our desks, that's killing us, and our eyesight is going bad, and we have, you know, neck, you know, structural skeletal problems in our neck because of text neck and because of the way we're sitting hunched over desks in a weird way, and all of these things that are pointing to this way is actually not ideal, that in fact we're suffering terribly. So we have to come away from this somehow. We have to kind of pull back a little bit from this, and yet we still consider it status, even when, you know, is that something that is that incumbent upon leadership to change that tide, or where do you see that shift being?
Well, I think in order to really answer that question, we need to take a little step back, and that is, what is it that we really associate with busyness? Why is it that we're working so hard, and why is it that we're working so hard now? So in the U.S. in the last 30 years, average working hours have increased. So it's that people have been working harder, even though, you know, productivity has gone up, even though there have been technological advancements, or even though you could say we don't have to work as hard, people have been working longer. And it's interesting that in the same time period in the last 30 years, in a lot of European countries, there have been shortages of working hours. France and Germany have gone down to 35 hours a week and even less. Well, at the same time, in America, the hours have just increased. And I think one thing that goes hand in hand in that is the pursuit of passion. So, you know, we can think of passion as a set of goals, but we can also think of passion as something that we really care about. And when we do, when we engage in the pursuit of something that we really care about, we sometimes really want to be busy. We want to show to other people that we're doing whatever we can in order to obtain that higher level long-term goal that we really care about. And it's, you know, perhaps it's no coincidence that the Germans have a word for passion that perhaps encapsulates it. The German word for passion, Leidenschaft, literally translates to the ability to endure hardship. And so when I'm passionate about something, when I have a goal that I care about very deeply, I might sometimes have circumstances that are not ideal, that are not fun. You know, I'm struggling and I'm striving at the same time, which might perhaps translate to, you know, I'm really busy. I'm actually really tired. I haven't slept in days. But that is a signal, perhaps to others, but as well to myself, that I really care about this goal and I'm passionate about this goal, that this is something that I want to pursue and that I have a lot of agency in pursuing it. So by having this idea of passion and by emphasizing the pursuit of passion in our graduation speeches, in company mission statements, another thing that we're doing, perhaps inadvertently, is that we're highlighting that people have these gaps of unmet passion, that, you know, perhaps we should be more passionate for what we're doing than we already are. And, you know, perhaps we're shaming other people who are not quite as passionate, where perhaps we don't perceive others to be as interesting or as competent or as warm when they're not passionate about a goal. You know, we wonder, it's like, you know, you have all this talent, all this possibility that you're just wasting because you're not passionate about a goal. You know, why aren't you striving harder? Why aren't you being busy? Well, at the same time, people, you know, some people are passionate about what they're doing and some people aren't passionate about what they're doing. But one way to get around that is for people just to signal that they're busy, because if they're busy, then surely they must care about what they're doing, because why else are they spending so much time doing it? Why else are they killing themselves in the progress of this long-term goal? So it's almost like a defense mechanism that people have adopted in order to get around questioning around their worth, around their self-worth. People are able to maybe put a little shadow over any weakness that they might have, and it's just highlight that they have a lot of agency and that they take their life into their own hands and that they're really driving things forward.
Yeah, I mean, right, as you're saying that, I'm thinking immediately of elite athletes and like ballet, you know, premier ballet dancers who work so hard, and you know how hard people have to work to succeed in those fields, and we think about those. When it comes to the business world, I think it's less clear sometimes what goes into that. It's not like you can, you know, rehearse or train or practice or, you know, and so I think sometimes things tend to get lost in jargon and the word busy has become encapsulating. So I kind of, two things came to mind as you were saying that. One is this idea that perhaps we should strive for a bit more specificity in our language instead of just, oh, I'm crazy busy, maybe conveying some of that passion, or I'm so exhausted, but I'm thrilled that this is finally happening, or something like that, to say something more clearly instead of letting it land and couching it in busy, which I think is starting to lose its meaning. But then at the same time, I start to wonder the other end of that spectrum where it's fear, which we touched on a little bit earlier. We want to show that we are making progress even when we're not, you know? So I think sometimes people are like, oh yeah, I'm so busy doing all the things, when, you know, when in fact, perhaps they're fearful that they're not moving on their goal quick enough.
Yeah. And I think, you know, no one better said it than Thoreau, who said, you know, it's not enough to be busy, so are the ends. The question is, what are we busy about? And I think sometimes we are busy out of a self-protection. We're busy for no other reason other than to be busy and to signal to other people that we're worth something. What gets lost in this process of being busy is really asking ourselves, why are we doing what we're doing? What's the purpose of this particular action? Is what I'm doing right now really bringing me closer to my goal? Is now the right time to do it? Do I really have to do it right now? Or perhaps should I rest? Should I spend some time with my family or my friends? Should I take some time to engage in a little bit of self-care? Might I be better off tackling this problem tomorrow? Perhaps when I'm more rested, when I have a better mindset. So it's an interesting idea that by telling other people that I am busy, I'm able to, you know, immediately shut up all conversations. I can immediately close myself off and say, hey, I am, you know, my time is worth it. I'm continuously striving toward my goal. Whereas you can imagine the same person who is, you know, engaging in leisure time or in self-care or spending time with her friends or with her family, who, you know, other people might question and say, shouldn't you be working right now? Don't you have a deadline tomorrow? Shouldn't you be killing it and crushing it right now? Why aren't you? And then that puts people on the defensive. So that's this thing that's happening is that we have this accusation, this perception, this immediate lay theory, this intuition that people who are not working are lazy. That when I'm not working, I'm not striving toward my goal. That when I'm not working, I'm not ambitious. Whereas really, sometimes when I'm not working, I'm preparing myself for my goal pursuit in other ways, right? So sometimes when I'm faced with a problem, sitting down at my desk and trying to solve the problem for 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, it's not going to get any better if I sit there for 8 hours, mm-hmm. even though I could tell other people that I've been busy. Sometimes I need to get up from my desk and go for a run, or I need to get a cup of coffee with a friend or a coworker, or colleague. And then when I come back from that break and I look at the problem again, you know, I see that there's a solution that I just didn't think of before. But only by not being busy for a while, by giving my mind a bit of a reprieve, was I able to then actually reassess the situation and see a solution to a problem that I haven't quite seen before. So I think that's just this accusation that we have, this immediate jump that we make, that when someone is not working, they're not pursuing their goals, they're not being ambitious, that they're being lazy. I think that's what drives people, at least in part, to just say that they're busy, because no one likes being called lazy.
Right. And I think we have even our language around that on both ends of that spectrum, too. There's contempt, because on one end of it, you have, oh, what a lazy bum. That person isn't working enough. And then on the other end of it, there's sort of a scoffing at someone who is perceived to be leisure class. And, oh, gosh, wouldn't it be nice to just not be able to do anything? You know, I think both ends of that get equal amounts of contempt from people.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's interesting is that what we're not doing in this process is that we're questioning ourselves what our fundamental values are. We're not questioning ourselves what we really care about, right? So we have perhaps these smaller goals that we have in front of us, a deadline, a presentation, something that we want to achieve. But by constantly being busy, we're not really asking ourselves about the big picture. We're not really taking the time to be reflective and saying, why am I doing what I'm doing? And what is it that I really care about? And what are the values that I'm satisfying by engaging the things that I engage in? And then perhaps even taking it further and asking, do I really have to engage in everything that I need to engage in order to satisfy my values within the realm of work? Or perhaps are there some values that I don't need to satisfy within a work environment that I perhaps should satisfy outside of my work environment, right? Are there perhaps some things that I don't necessarily need to do at work that I need to do outside of work in order to be productive, in order to be satisfied, in order to continue to have drive and motivation and ambition to continue killing it at work, right? And by being busy all the time, we're not allowing ourselves to have these questions emerge at all.
Yes, and I think we also are doing ourselves a great disservice by not giving ourselves time to contemplate. I think that's a big one we skip, because it doesn't look like you're doing anything when you're just contemplating. It looks like just sitting quietly or something. And I think often we kind of penalize that or don't prioritize that when really, you know, all the big successful thinkers of the world have prioritized contemplation or have gone to do something else, that, you know, like the shower principle, right? Go do something else and the answer will come to your mind.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. There's it's kind of interesting because with my supervisor and I, I've instituted this thing where there's one evening a week where I will not respond to emails no matter how urgent it is, and he knows it's that evening. And that evening, I take a couple of salsa classes. So I dance salsa. And so between the hours of, say, 6:30 and 9:30 p.m. Tuesday evenings, even if he wants to contact me, even if he needs an immediate response because we're in the middle of teaching and he needs some quick response, he knows he's not going to be able to get me because that's a time period where I switch off my phone and I do something that's completely unrelated to work. I dance salsa and I'm engaged with another human being. And it's interesting that, salsa is an interesting context because in salsa, when you're paying attention to something that is not salsa, you find out immediately because your salsa partner is so dissatisfied with your leading. And, you know, there's immediate feedback when it works well because your salsa partner smiles or is excited or is engaged. And what's really wonderful is that when I get back from salsa and, you know, I look at the emails that my boss might have sent if it's been a really busy week and there's a lot that still needs to get done. But I have a completely different framework. I have a completely different way of looking at it. And it really allows me to then be motivated again and allows me to have a bit better of a perspective of why I'm doing what I'm doing. And at the same time, sometimes I can look at these emails and say, you know what, it's 9:30 p.m. I don't need to respond to these emails right now. They're not that urgent. I can look at them tomorrow morning. It's fine. I can respond to them later. And that's it, really. And I can then completely disengage and have a much, much better evening.
Yes, I absolutely hear that. I, too, have a night every single week that is protected for yoga. My phone is not in that yoga studio with me. If the world could be falling apart, and I wouldn't know the difference because I am busy blissed out in a yoga studio. I absolutely hear that. And I think that speaks to that notion of you can't pour from an empty cup. You know, that we get so, you know, frustrated and worn thin. And if we're not, filling our own emotional and just energetic tank, we're not going to be able to give to others or do quality work for sure.
Yeah, there's an amazing psychologist that I admire called Brian Little, and he calls it acting out of character. So acting out of character has two meanings. On the one hand, I can act out of character when I'm acting in ways that do not accord with my character, right? So if I'm an introvert, but I had to teach classes all day, so engage in very extroverted type of behavior, that can be very depleting. I can be very tired because I had to act out of character. But acting out of character also has a second meaning, and that is acting because of my character, right? So I'm acting in ways that are in accordance with my character. And that is, I can find restorative niches. So I can find particular areas within my surroundings, whether it's my work environment or my private life, where I can act in ways that are in accordance with my personality. So if I'm an introvert, perhaps I'll be reading a book, or I'll be going for a run, or I'll go to yoga class. So engage in ways that reflect who I am and that reflect my personality really well. And what Brian Little has shown in decades worth of research is that the more I engage in the type one acting out of character, so acting in ways that are in dissonance with my personality, the more I need to engage in the type two acting out of character. So engaging in these restorative niches where I can act in ways that are in concordance with my personality. And it's really interesting that when we're busy, sometimes we might be acting in ways that are more dissonant with our personality, but that actually just makes it more and more important that we act in ways that are in concordance with our personality.
That is a very interesting point too. I've often thought about that because I know a lot of people that limit their, you know, they'll say, I'm an introvert, but I have an extroverted job. So I'm going to only have one night a week where I socialize. Otherwise it'll be depleting. I totally hear that. I think that's a really important thing to know. Well, unfortunately we are running out of time, but I appreciate you joining us. I feel like we could talk for two more hours about all this stuff. It is so interesting. And I do appreciate your passion around the topic. Thank you so much for being with us, Jan Jakimovic. We will talk with you again soon.
Thank you, Amy. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNradio.com. If you are an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio. The news is sponsored by Bailey's Harbor Yacht Club Resort. It is 9 o'clock. Here is our good friend, David Jennings.